is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Tom Joslin and Bill Roggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They are senior fellows, and they and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Long War Journal watching the tragedy in Kabul and the larger conflict with the Ummah stretching over from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean. We begin, however, with reports that are mentioned repeatedly, but you have to be careful about the sources here. There's not transparent reporting anymore inside Afghanistan. There are sources mentioning that things are either better or worse for the people left behind. We're especially keen on decisions being made in Kabul by the new Kabul city government. Dateline Associated Press. Female employees in the Kabul city government have been told to stay home, with work only allowed for those who cannot be replaced by men. This according to the interim mayor of Afghanistan's capital. Witnesses said an explosion targeted a Taliban vehicle in the eastern provincial city of Jalalabad. Hospital officials said five people were killed in the second such deadly blast in as many days. Those two headlines we'll now apply ourselves before we pull back and look at the larger picture of how the Taliban is taking over the government and the people of Afghanistan. Bill, I begin with you because this statement by the city government of Kabul telling the women who work for it to stay home is suggestive that the Taliban 2.0 is the Taliban 1.0. What can you tell me about this statement, Bill? Good morning to you.
Good morning, John. Yeah, this is just what we all should have expected. Look, there's been a host of Taliban apologists out there prior to the fall of Kabul that told us the Taliban were moderating, the Taliban were willing to change and embrace more modern positions. And then Kabul falls and Afghanistan falls. And as you noted, you said it perfectly. Taliban 2.0 is Taliban 1.0. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. It's what we all expected. You, me, Tom, we're not, your listeners, we shouldn't be shocked by any of this. Tracking the Taliban's operations over the years, their statements, and how they were governing in areas that they controlled. You knew this was coming. The Taliban was stoning women and men for having extramarital affairs and chopping off people's hands. So what did we expect? How did we think the Taliban were going to treat women once they took control of power? You know, one of the things that I noticed immediately after the government collapsed was sales of burqas. The cost of burqas in Kabul just skyrocketed. Burqas, obviously, are the full body clothing that the women are forced to wear so they can cover themselves up. I think they went up by like 10 times the normal cost. Meanwhile, as the economy of Afghanistan is collapsing, that, you know, women are rushing and paying exorbitant prices to wear burqas. This is what we could expect. And an interesting, this story that you're mentioning, it was it used to be the Ministry of Women's Affairs that the Taliban, they took it over, and now it's the, they replaced it with the Ministry for the, I believe it's the, propagation of virtue and prevention of vice. It's the virtue and vice ministry. This is the one that ensures that the Taliban is enforcing their harsh brand of Sharia. The Taliban is clearly sending a message to all the women of Afghanistan and to the rest of the world that it's going to be business as usual, Taliban business as usual.
And your expectation, Bill, is that there'll be more of these stories coming out in the coming weeks and months, and that there's no surprise here to the people in Afghanistan. The only people who have not yet understood this are the general audience in the United States and in Europe. Is that correct, Bill?
Yeah, that's correct. I think, it's interesting, John. I think the average people that I talk to understand this. I think the intellectual and policymaking class in Washington and Europe have still failed to grasp the fact that the Taliban is actually the Taliban is the Taliban we all remember. I think, ironically, the media, the press really seems to have grasped this fact. Now, the only question is going to be, are these stories going to continue to come out? The Taliban has already made statements by beating journalists and kidnapping journalists. That's happening now. And once the, you know, is there a point where this dries up? Are we going to start keep seeing these videos that are coming out? That's the real question to me is, will this drumbeat of reporting continue?
Tom, I come to you with this story of an explosion in Jalalabad. Jalalabad, everyone will remember, is the city, the large city on your way to the Khyber Pass, the traditional transition into Pakistan. Jalalabad was also a city that was extremely favorable. My memory, Tom, help me. To Al-Qaeda early in the conflict. This is back to 2001, 2002. And I believe Jalalabad was one of the cities that bin Laden was said to have retreated to before he went to Tora Bora. So what has happened in Jalalabad and what is the significance, Tom?
Well, you know, the Islamic State has maintained a small foothold in Nangarhar, which is the province in eastern Afghanistan. Jalalabad is the capital of Nangarhar. For some years, as of early 2016, the Islamic State actually controlled upwards of 10 districts in Nangarhar, but they lost that territory during offensives and battles against the U.S. military, the now deposed Afghan government, and as well as rival jihadists from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda maintains a presence in Nangarhar to this day. And after the Taliban's takeover, the Islamic State has been looking in mid-August. The Islamic State has been looking for an opportunity to carry out some sort of small-scale attacks against the Taliban wherever they can. And what's happened over the weekend is that the Islamic State claimed responsibility for 7 improvised explosive device bombings in Jalalabad, the capital of Nangarhar, targeting Taliban convoys. They claim that there were 35 casualties incurred on the Taliban, including those killed and wounded. Those numbers, of course, haven't been independently corroborated, but basically they were able to execute these IED attacks on Taliban convoys throughout Jalalabad, the city of Jalalabad, including one that was near the an Indian consulate of some sort, I guess, in Jalalabad as well. So it's not surprising. The Islamic State obviously rejects the Taliban's authority, rejects its Islamic Emirate. So far, they haven't been able to actually beat the Taliban, of course, in battle. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are a much stronger force in Afghanistan. And, you know, John, it's interesting. You see these attacks in Jalalabad. One of the things that Bill and I have talked about for years is that the U.S. military became myopically obsessed with the Islamic State's presence in Afghanistan because it was something that was smaller and that they could actually target and turn back. Meanwhile, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were taking over the country. So basically, this is the smaller dog trying to nip at the bigger dog here in Afghanistan.
A puzzle, Tom. I believe I've read, and I can't go to the source right now, that the U.S. was looking to cooperate or comment or dialogue with the Taliban in its opposition to ISIS. Is that accurate? And is the U.S. participating in any fashion in surveillance or security or ordnance against ISIS with communication with Taliban? Do we know?
Right now, we don't know if the U.S. is doing much of anything. I doubt it, actually, given the chaos of the withdrawal and the fact that Taliban rejects the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. But it's absolutely true that the U.S. provided de facto air cover for the Taliban and, in fact, Al-Qaeda in Nangarhar, this province where these bombings took place against the Islamic State. It's one of the things that Al-Qaeda has actually documented in its Urdu literature. It's something that the CENTCOM commander and U.S. military officials have basically admitted that there was some level of cooperation here between the Taliban and the U.S. to take the fight to the Islamic State in Nangarhar. And this really goes to show just how confused and really degraded the U.S. military's leadership became over time, because they focused on the Islamic State in Nangarhar and the Islamic State's territory in Nangarhar, and didn't realize and couldn't process and certainly didn't have a game plan for combating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which were actually going to take over Nangarhar and the city of Jalalabad and indeed the entire country.
The additional puzzle for me, Tom, is reading about the drone strike that killed a U.S.-affiliated aid worker and several children. I believe that was a drone strike. That's my sense of things. And it was meant to be directed against ISIS. Now, that happened in Kabul. So can we isolate the drone strike of Kabul from any possible interference or strikes in other cities, such as Jalalabad or Mazar-e-Sharif or Herat? Do we know, is the U.S. maintaining drone surveillance? Do we have any knowledge?
So after the Islamic State claimed responsibility for the suicide bombing at the airport in Kabul that left 13 U.S. service members dead and more than a dozen others wounded, and conveniently, of course, the suicide bomber was able to just prance right through Taliban security checkpoints in the dead heat of summer in Kabul, laced with explosives and wasn't detected somehow. But in any event, after the Islamic State claimed responsibility for that, the U.S. actually conducted two drone strikes. One was in Nangarhar, which is the same province where these bombings took place in Jalalabad, these IED attacks. The second one, and we don't have any visibility on who was actually targeted there. The second one was in Kabul against the supposed ISIS cell, which was supposedly going to attack the Americans at the airport again. It's now the U.S. military has come out. There was actually some very good reporting by the press, to its credit, New York Times and elsewhere, showing that, in fact, this was not an ISIS cell, that this were just civilians, and that the main guy who was targeted was actually carrying water jugs, not explosives and not gasoline or anything like that. It was just basically an aid worker who was carrying water. He and members of his family and others were killed. There were 10 civilians killed, including 7 children. The U.S. military has come out and apologized for this. But I think we need to have some questions here. A couple things. One, this demonstrates how much the U.S. became myopically obsessed with ISIS. In part, that's understandable given the suicide bombing outside the Kabul airport and the fact that ISIS is a nasty character, of course, in all this. But how did they actually get this intelligence to go after this these civilians, these aid workers? Did the Taliban play a role in this? Did the Taliban give them the intelligence that led to this attack? Because if so, that shows the Taliban is not the counterterrorism partner the U.S. military is making it out to be.
Tom Joslin, Bill Raggio, they are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. The website to follow these stories and much more is the Long War Journal. We're going to turn to, right now, a question that Bill raises about a billboard. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is John Batchelor, CBS Eye on the World, discussing with Tom Joslin and Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. What we know now about the Taliban and a billboard. Bill, you feature a billboard that looks to have the U.S. soldier who was kept captive for almost 5 years, Bo Bergdahl. What is this poster meant to represent, Bill?
Yeah, so this poster, I believe it's in Pashto. It's basically what it says is it's saying it's celebrating Mulla Sangin for holding Bergdahl and that he was a hero of the jihad. So Mulla Sangin Zadran, who is he? That's the important thing here. He was a leader of the Taliban. He was their governor, as well as their military commander at one point in Paktika province. His group kidnapped and held Bo Bergdahl, who abandoned his post and was wandering in Paktika province and was captured by Mulla Sangin's followers. That was in 2009. The U.S. killed him in a drone strike in 2013. He was a member of the Haqqani Network, which, of course, is part of the Taliban. It's very senior Haqqani leader. He deeply in bed with al-Qaeda, sheltered al-Qaeda fighters, fought alongside them, trained them, recruited foreigners to fight in Afghanistan, and was actually talking about waging jihad outside of Afghanistan as well. The U.S. killed him, of course, in North Waziristan, in Pakistan, in 2013 in a drone strike. When he was killed, a senior or a mid-level al-Qaeda bomb maker, an Egyptian, was killed alongside him. So, you know, as he lived, so as with al-Qaeda, he died alongside al-Qaeda. So what you have here is the Taliban celebrating, and he was considered one of the most effective military commanders, attacked numerous U.S. outposts, directly responsible for the death of American soldiers in the coast, Paktika area. And the Taliban, you know, they're rubbing it in our face, John. This is really the only thing I could come away with when looking at this stuff, putting this. And note, too, there's an interesting thing. The Taliban is talking. They don't have money. And yet these billboards like this and other billboards are not springing up just in Kabul, but across the country. I'm seeing things like this. And they're not they're pretty slick. So clearly the Taliban was prepared with an advertising campaign. I mean, Kabul is pasted with billboards and paintings and things of that celebrating the Taliban victory. So they certainly have enough money for things like that. But, you know, but back to Sangin, Mulla Sangin Zadran, he is you know, we were tracking him. He's a specially designated global terrorist, et cetera, et cetera. He's the perfect example of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, dual-hatted commanders, so to speak. These are leaders who have a foot in both camps. Was he Taliban? Was he Al-Qaeda? He was both. And that's what makes the Taliban so dangerous. And that's what makes the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in some ways an Al-Qaeda takeover.
You have a quote from an interview 4 years before Sangin's death. He's asked, how is your relation with your brothers in Al-Qaeda? What is the level of cooperation? You've translated it for me, Bill. And after the usual ceremonial praise for Allah, we do not see any difference between Taliban and Al-Qaeda, for we are all belong to the religion of Islam. There is no difference between us, for we are united by Islam and the Sharia governs us. Just as the infidels are one people, so are the Muslims, and they will never succeed in disuniting the Mujahideen, saying that there is Al-Qaeda and Taliban and that Al-Qaeda are terrorists and extremists. They use many such words, but by the grace of Allah, it will not affect our brotherly relationship. Bill, there's no ambiguity there. There's no other way to take that statement. Now, that's 4 years before his death. Could that have gone out of date, Bill? Do we have any indication that the Taliban decided to take it back?
No, there's zero indication that there's that this has changed. And note, by the way, this was an interview with Al-Sahab, which is Al-Qaeda's official media outlet. He didn't make this statement to like some offhand statement to a reporter. He was being interviewed by Al-Qaeda when he made this statement. So, yeah, and there's no indications that 8 years after his death that anything has changed. And if in fact, the relationship has only gotten stronger. Al-Qaeda has played a key role in this Taliban victory. I mean, look, Dr. Amin al-Haq, who was Osama bin Laden's the head of the Black Guard, Osama bin Laden's security detail, who ushered him out of the Battle of Tora Bora and into Pakistan. He returned to his home in Nangarhar province under a parade of the Taliban with the Taliban flags flying. And he was treated as a conquering hero. If anything changed, it certainly isn't indicated by Amin al-Haq's return to Nangarhar. And, you know, there's so much more evidence that Tom and I could discuss on this. But, yeah, nothing's changed, John.
We're going to turn to al-Qaeda next. But just a note here, Tom, this billboard is raised in Khost Province, which is, as Bill reports, the Haqqani Network. Have you seen any indication from CENTCOM or from speakers for the Defense Department that they're willing to recognize that al-Qaeda is now integrated into the Taliban? There have been reports saying maybe 1 or 2 years, but do you see any registration of the fact that al-Qaeda is already here?
You know, the rhetoric coming out of the Defense Department and the U.S. establishment is as confused as ever, John. They never really understood what they were looking at when it came to al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. When they talk about a year or two and al-Qaeda's comeback, I suspect what they're really talking about is the ability to conduct external operations. That means plot against the West from Afghan soil. But the point is that that's all guesswork. The truth is that we know that al-Qaeda is riddled throughout the entire insurgency that overtook Kabul, that overthrew the Afghan government. The idea that al-Qaeda needs to have a comeback in general into Afghanistan just shows they don't really understand al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's been there the whole time.
We're going to turn to al-Qaeda and 9/11. Because as we noted the 20th year of the war on terror or the long war, so did al-Qaeda. Bill Rajo, Tom Jossen, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jossen and Bill Rajo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They keep the Long War Journal, which I highly recommend to watch the reporting that's coming out of Afghanistan and the region in these weeks and months and years henceforth, because the Taliban is non-transparent, but it has a sophisticated understanding of moving its message not only to its allies and the Arab world, the Ummah, but also to Europe and the United States. And we come now to the registration of 9/11 by Al-Sahab, which is a media branch, sophisticated media branch. These are not men living in caves who don't have electricity, We're talking about extremely careful arrangements of staging, opera. They understand it, that the image is everything and the timing of the image is equally important. Tom, you've written up the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 hijackings by Al-Sahab. What is Al-Sahab? Where do we think it exists? And is there a unique or advanced presentation because of the handover of Afghanistan to Taliban?
Well, you know, it's interesting, John. Al-Sahab is the longstanding central media arm for Al-Qaeda's senior leadership. We know from the U.S. State Department and other sources that it's actually headquartered in Iran, inside Iran, that Abdulrahman al-Maghrebi, who is the son-in-law of Ayman al-Zawahiri and a senior al-Qaeda leader, he's the longtime director of Al-Sahab, and he's based in Iran and has been based in Iran since 2015. Now, with the 9/11 anniversary this year, of course, you would expect a lot of different videos and statements to come out from al-Qaeda. They didn't put out that much material. And I suspect, John, looking at watching everything I watched on social media from al-Qaeda accounts, I suspect that there was actually some disruption from external actors in terms of what they put out. I wouldn't be surprised if we learn sometime in the future that the U.S. or its allies actually interfered with the electronic distribution of al-Qaeda's materials on 9/11 anniversary. They did put out a video that featured Ayman al-Zawahiri that documented that Ayman al-Zawahiri actually is alive. Remember, there were all these so-called experts in the counterterrorism community, really a lot of charlatans who were pretending that Zawahiri was dead and they knew he was dead for some time. And of course, that wasn't true. He wasn't dead at all. But, you know, this video basically was aimed at sort of, you know, providing another message, a global narrative for the jihad, for al-Qaeda and its various iterations. What I would say is this, however, I just wrote up at Longword Journal another video that came out. This is part of what we've detected in al-Qaeda's media apparatus. They've actually distributed responsibility to lesser known al-Qaeda affiliated media groups. One of them is this group known as Nashir al-Khair. I wrote the video because it's a very interesting look at how they're portraying 9/11 in the historical context. A lot of it isn't new, but some of it is a little bit new. They open basically with scenes of the Taliban special forces. And if you listen to Bill and myself through the years, you know that we've collected evidence showing that al-Qaeda played a very prominent role in training, inspiring, and directing the Taliban special forces. And so this 9/11 video opens with these guys who are very elite paramilitary trained commandos. And it puts them in the context of al-Qaeda's global campaign of terrorism, their terrorism against the West and 9/11 and similar attacks, which is a very interesting framing for this. And one of the things I suspect going forward, John, is that this type of training, if not these types of trainees, and maybe some of these experienced commandos, this type of training does lend itself for attacks in the West against civilian targets and others. So I wouldn't be surprised if this video is sort of a leading indicator of the next stage of the sort of the Mumbai style attacks that we could see plotted by al-Qaeda and its various branches.
I'm looking at some of the stills that you've included of Nashir al-Khair, and I'm noting that the terrain looks strikingly familiar. Do we know where this is? Is this in Afghanistan? And is this affiliated with the training camps that we've long talked about that are difficult to locate?
You know, John, it's familiar to you because you've read through all of Bill's write-ups of the Taliban special forces training camps through the years, and some of it is the same imagery. Some of it's the same scenery, same camps, same places. But isn't it telling that this al-Qaeda affiliated group is using this imagery, is using this footage as if it's its own, as if it's al-Qaeda's footage, and folding it into this 9/11 related narrative? That's what's interesting to me about the video, is that it's sort of a wink and a nod to the fact that al-Qaeda was playing a heavy role in directing these special forces and training them all along. And we know from the UN Security Council, from all the granular reporting we've done on al-Qaeda figures who have been killed in Afghanistan, operational evidence, all sorts of documents, all sorts of evidence that, in fact, al-Qaeda has been playing this role in the Taliban special forces. So it isn't new to us that this would be the case, but it's interesting that they're advertising it in a 9/11 narrative.
Bill, about the training that we're witnessing, and over the years, as Tom says, I've watched a lot of the videos that you provided, leaping through fire circles, as I recall, a lot of demonstration of what you'd have to say are circus trips. Circus tricks. Do we, in any sense, understand how they recruit their special forces? Do we know about the unit that you identified as Taliban special forces that was in Kabul? Do we know where they come from? Are they Afghan natives? Are they from Arab countries? Are they from everywhere?
So, John, it's difficult to know. And the Taliban is not transparent on this issue. But I can, I do believe, and first of all, that border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, is the Durand line, is very fluid. So it's very likely that members of it are Pakistani. Keep in mind, groups like the Haqqani Network and other Taliban groups span the tribes, span the border. So that wouldn't be a shock if they're Pakistanis. A lot of people along that border don't view themselves as Afghans or Pakistanis particularly. But I've seen in a lot of these videos, John, where people's faces were blurred out. And it wasn't the commander of the groups, but often fighters. And in a lot of cases, you'll see them, they're all masked. Now, it could be they're protecting individual identity. But in the videos where where you will see faces and then faces are blurred, that is typically an indication that someone is either a member of Al-Qaeda or another jihadist group. Again, I'm making a little leap there, but that's what we've seen in past videos, both from Afghanistan and Pakistan. It is usually a tell that someone may be not be either like from the Afghan or Pakistan area. So again, can't prove it, John, but that's we do know, though. Again, Mullah Sangin Zadran, he was involved in training and recruiting. He was calling for Turkmen and for Turkish and Kurdish and other foreign fighters to come to Afghanistan. We know that there's been individuals from the Caucasus and from Arab countries and even from Africa that have come and fought in Afghanistan. So I don't think I suspect that when we see a lot of those blurred images, that's what we're getting here, is that those were indeed foreigners serving within the Taliban special forces. And one more quick point, John.
Yeah.
Just if I may. You know, the jumping through hoops and everything, people laughed at that. And yeah, there sort of is a comical thing. But well, you got to understand, to them, those are confidence building. And you know, it's a way for them to build their esprit de corps. And we don't jump through fire in the U.S. military or anything like that. But there are similar silly things that other foreign cultures might look at us going over monkey bars or whatever else is being done, and look at that and laugh and say, look at how sophomoric that is. But there's specific reasons for doing that.
I'm looking at some of the videos from the past. And, Bill, these men, young men, are uniformed in fatigues and they're training martial arts or with automatic weapons. This is a very far from the characters we're presented to in Kabul these last weeks. The ragamuffins, the bearded ones carrying Kalashnikov, standing around in what appear to be rags and sandals. So is there that distinction of dress made in the Taliban? Some people get really cool uniforms that are made in China, and some people have to deal with their mother's rags?
Yes, yeah, so this goes back well over a decade when the Taliban issued directives about fighting in Afghanistan. And one of the things they had told their fighters is dress like the locals. So you have two Taliban militaries here is what you are seeing in Kabul. You're having your average Taliban fighters. Some of these are coming in from the districts outside of Kabul or from provinces like Logar, Wardak, Lagman, Parwan. They came in and to help secure Kabul for the Taliban. And then you had your professional Taliban military, your special forces is what the Taliban refers to them. Those are the ones you're seeing with the uniformed with helmets and American weapons and, you know, with the night vision goggles. So that's the more professionalized Taliban military. And that's what they refer to their special forces. So that's what you've been witnessing in Kabul. You know, so the Taliban now has created a defense department and has a chief of staff. I suspect you'll start seeing the average Taliban foot soldier more often than not wearing uniforms at some point in the future. But you'll still probably have this local, your local Taliban dressing as a regular Afghan would.
Bill Rajo, Tom Jostin, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They keep the long word journal. We're going to turn to Al-Qaeda, what we know next. Bill and Tom address it in their new podcast, Generation Jihad. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio, Tom Jostin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They do a highly recommended podcast, Generation Jihad, when they have time, given all the information coming in from the collapse of Afghanistan these last weeks. And their most recent iteration addresses what we know and what we don't know about al-Qaeda, what we need to know, because al-Qaeda remains a transnational organization with representatives in the Arabian Gulf, in the Islamic Maghreb, in sub-Saharan Africa, in East Africa. There are several other versions. One, of course, we're looking at in Afghanistan. Another one we're looking at in the subcontinent. Tom, I begin with you on what we know about al-Qaeda following the success of Taliban in Afghanistan. Is there indication that al-Qaeda is re-energized or reawakened or getting new financing? I note we had that story just last week about several al-Qaeda financiers being sanctioned in their refuge in Turkey. Is that an indication of strength or just business as usual, Tom?
Well, you know, John, I would say this. There were basically all the years Bill and I have been doing this, there were two models of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. One was the dominant sort of herd model, which said that al-Qaeda was basically defunct and was defeated, degraded. You know, Bill likes to say that they had all these different D words to emphasize that basically al-Qaeda was on death's door. And then there was the reporting and analysis we did, which documented al-Qaeda's persistent and resilient presence across Afghanistan. And in our model, al-Qaeda was heavily invested in the Taliban's insurgency against the government in Kabul, was heavily invested in defeating the U.S.-backed government and the U.S. military in Afghanistan. And so the fact from our perspective is this is actually a major victory for al-Qaeda. And in fact, al-Qaeda says that this is an historic victory in Afghanistan. I think that more details are going to come out. But here's the thing. One of the ways you can tell that al-Qaeda was integrated into this whole operation all along was just looking at the cabinet ministers named by the Taliban. 17 of the 33 were sanctioned as early as January and February of 2001, John. So they were known by the UN to be bad actors with ties to al-Qaeda and terrorist and affiliated terrorist groups more than 20 years ago. And they were sanctioned for that 8 months before 9/11. So this is why we say that the Taliban 2.0 is really the Taliban 1.0, because these guys were just waiting to take over once again. But look at the guy who's the head of state for the Taliban, the guy who's they call him prime minister in some sources, but we know that's not a real, they don't have a real European style of government. But the guy is named Hassan Akhund. What was he responsible for? Well, prior to 9/11, after the U.S. embassy bombings that al-Qaeda conducted in Africa, it was Hassan Akhund who came out and defied the UN. When the UN said, turn over Osama bin Laden, Akhund came out and said, we will not turn over Osama bin Laden at any price. He was then the foreign minister of the Taliban. Today, he's the so-called head of state for the group. We've talked about Sirajuddin Haqqani, the interior minister. He's an al-Qaeda man. We've talked about all these other figures. The head of the intelligence for the Taliban was a former Gitmo detainee named Abdulhaq Wasiq. He was sanctioned by the UN. Why? Because he worked with al-Qaeda. And we can go on and on and on like this. You mentioned Khost earlier. The new governor of Khost is Nabi Omari, another former Gitmo detainee. When he was detained at Gitmo, why was he detained? And why was he sanctioned by the UN? Because he worked with al-Qaeda as a member of the Haqqani network. So the bottom line, John, is that al-Qaeda was integrated into this whole insurgency and now this whole government that took over Afghanistan. That's consistent with what we've been reporting for years. And I think a lot of people have failed to understand that.
Bill, at least since April, at least since the United States made the announcement that it was leaving at such and such a date, 9/11 or the end of August, at least since then, there's been a consistent theme of Taliban denying or refuting the claim that al-Qaeda was present or in any fashion was working with Taliban as it advanced on Kabul. Has that gone away, that denial, Bill? I know I'm looking for something that's not there anymore, but we talked week after week, I know, because I've made this available to my audience, week after week about how, well, that's al-Qaeda, but they're denying it. Do you see any change in their rhetoric, Bill?
No, no change whatsoever. The Taliban spokesmen continue to come out and say al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. And what they've even continue with their 9/11, their version of 9/11 trutherism and say there's no evidence that Al-Qaeda even carried out 9/11, which is funny because Osama bin Laden and other senior Al-Qaeda leaders and Al-Sahab often take credit. Well, bin Laden, of course, took credit for it when he was alive. So, yeah, there's zero change whatsoever. I mean, and this is the irony of all this. The U.S. says, you know, look, we have to consider, you know, the Taliban as a, you know, General Milley called, or McKenzie, I'm sorry, the commander at CENTCOM, called them our Afghan partners, our partners who denied that Al-Qaeda carried out 9/11 and denies that Al-Qaeda remains in Afghanistan to this day.
Tom, I come to you about Al-Qaeda's presence right now, what we know, not just in Afghanistan, but everywhere. Is there any indication of new offensives or new organizations worldwide, because certainly they have the money for it?
Well, you know, look, the first priority for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is to consolidate their control and their regime in Afghanistan. This is the main thing Al-Qaeda was fighting for in Afghanistan all along, was to resurrect the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which was lost after the 9/11 hijackings. You know, this was a liability for Al-Qaeda, that basically the 9/11 hijackings caused the Taliban to lose the only religiously legitimate regime in their eyes on the planet. Well, now that regime is back. So they now have to consolidate its authority and its control across Afghanistan. They want to take some time to basically further embolden and enforce their version of Sharia law across Afghanistan. These are big matters for them to do. However, you know, one part of the model that Bill and I have been rebutting for so long is this idea that the Taliban is this purely nationalist cause that just wants to fight in Afghanistan, take over Afghanistan. Well, there's a whole bunch of evidence showing that's false, that in fact, much of the Taliban, which is in bed with Al-Qaeda and intertwined with Al-Qaeda, has aspirations not only to take over Afghanistan once again, which is something that Washington denied, but actually to export the jihad, to take over territory in Pakistan, to embolden the jihad in Kashmir, to launch attacks in India and elsewhere throughout the region and indeed the world. So I think that there's plenty of evidence along those lines. I think that the first priority for the Taliban Al-Qaeda is to consolidate their regime and their power. It's only, you know, we're only a few weeks in now, about a month into them owning Afghanistan once again. That's going to take some time. But, you know, we shouldn't be surprised when you see the uptick of jihadists flowing out of Afghanistan and plots tracing back to Afghanistan.
Bill, I've seen rhetoric from ISIS, wherever it is. I never know the source. But anyway, a quote denouncing the Taliban as, I believe the term was, dirty nationalists or filthy nationalists. Do you see ISIS propaganda regularly denouncing the Taliban, Bill?
Yeah, that's a common theme from the Islamic State. They even call the Taliban basically a tool of the United States or a servant of the U.S. and the West, which is kind of ironic because that was the Taliban's rhetoric against the Afghan government. So, yeah, that animosity within the Islamic State, Khorasan province, towards the Taliban, it continues. The Islamic State demands allegiance to its emir. Nothing else will do. And it will and as long as it exists, it will remain a threat to the Taliban. Again, I view the Islamic State as more a thorn in the Taliban's side than a real threat to its ability to govern.
Final, Tom, I've done a story with Tunku Varadarajan of the Journal about the Afghan cricket team. And you tell me, you know who is in charge of the Afghan cricket team. There's some controversy whether they'll be able to do a world tour because of the Taliban's anti-female, anti-human stance. Who's in charge? We have about a minute, Tom. Who's in charge of the Afghanistan cricket team now that the Taliban is in charge?
Well, you know, John, after the Taliban takeover, there's uncertainty about what role these Afghan sports teams will continue to play internationally because, you know, the Taliban obviously has its own rules that don't comport with the way things were done under the former, now deposed Afghan government. Well, early on, the Taliban dispatched Anas Haqqani, who is the brother of Siraj Haqqani, the interior minister. This is a family that's deeply intertwined with Al-Qaeda. They dispatched Anas Haqqani to act as the diplomat with the cricket team to say all is well and you can continue to play. You know, Anas Haqqani is basically the Ron Burgundy of jihadism. He's sort of vapid. He'll just repeat whatever they put in front of him. But he's sort of the perfect diplomat from that perspective because he can play nice with the cricket team and pretend like all will be well. And so it's interesting that he in particular was picked for this mission.
Tom Jocelyn, Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense Science of Democracy, Senior Fellows, Long War Journal, and Generation Jihad is the podcast. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.